From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Imagine attending your chemistry class from your kitchen table or taking English Lit while sitting on a park bench. For a growing number of Utah students, this is what high school looks like. Classes online, teachers on chat, video casts and slideshows, and blogs. It's online education, which proponents say is more convenient, more individualized, and cheaper than brick-and-mortar schools. But what kind of results are we seeing from online classes? Are online students performing as well as their traditional peers, or is it just a good fit for those highly motivated, self-directed students? Today on the program, how technology is changing education here in Utah. Plus, finding out what Salt Lake County caregivers need and want. A new survey is underway. All that plus your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Used to be that we learned our three R's in a classroom with a chalkboard and a teacher at the head of the class. But today, high school students and teachers can chat online, lectures can be delivered on YouTube, and students can compare notes on a class blog. It's a brave new world in education with technology at the forefront. So, how are schools and teachers and students adapting to the rapid adoption of online classes? And what are the results? Today on the program, online education. Joining me now is Kenneth Grover, the Director of Career and Technical Education and Secondary Schools at the Salt Lake City School District. He's also chair of the Utah Online Education Consortium. And Kenneth Grover joins me in studio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also in studio, Delana Tonks. She's the director of the Open High School of Utah, an all-online charter school based here in Salt Lake City. And Delana Tonks, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Jennifer.
We invite you to join the conversation with your questions about online education. Parents, would you trust your ninth grader to take an all-online class or two? Teachers, is teaching as satisfying online as it is in the classroom? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Kenneth Grover, I want to start with you. You've been a teacher, a principal, now an administrator. How is online education changing school as we know it?
Well, currently in the Salt Lake City School District, we have students who've been able to participate in online courses through Utah Electronic High School for a number of years. However, with the current passage of Senate Bill 65, it's really actually created a nice way for students and parents to access online education in a different manner.
I understand there are over 100 classes that you can take online now, statewide. So why are school districts turning to this virtual environment?
Well, it's so much more than just the school districts turning to it. It's more about the students and parents and their choice and their options that are available in public education. And we need to be responsive to those needs and to the choices that parents and students want with public education, and providing those online formats perhaps more flexibility when they need it, different family dynamics, different situations that students actually learn better or find it to be more inviting to take a course or two or even their full curriculum online.
In the Salt Lake City School District case, who is teaching the classes?
Currently, we don't have any online courses currently established. We use Electronic High School as the format. So if a student wants to take an online course, they would go to the Electronic High School, which has been set up since 1997 by the State Office of Education to provide that online. And over time, we hope within the next year or two to be able to offer online courses in a blended model, which would mean students could take the courses at home or wherever they are, and then, of course, come to a classroom setting for where the teacher would be available to offer continual advice and instruction where a student might need it. It's called a blended model in some areas, and that's what we're hoping to eventually roll out here in the next year.
And is Salt Lake City reflective of other districts in the state? I mean, do you see that other districts are going to start to try their online courses as well, or are they going to try and outsource some of those classes to outside companies or whatever?
I think all districts will begin to are, all districts are currently beginning the offerings of online education because it is something that was built into legislation. Whether they use their own created courses, which we call homegrown courses, or whether they use providers that they can source it out, much like you'd buy a textbook, will be up to each district. But are all districts participating in some form? Yes, they are.
Okay. Delana Tonks, you're the principal of an all-online charter school, the Open High School. Tell us about the philosophy and the mission of this school and why it was founded.
Yeah, absolutely. The Open High School of Utah is based on four different principles. It all centers around the student. Our tagline is putting the focus where it should be, on the student. We focus on personal responsibility, individualized instruction, technology, and then our open source curriculum. And what that looks like is that we hire teachers a year before they actually start teaching. And they align open educational resources, which are resources that you can find on the web, that are lessons. They can be videos, they can be game type things, they can be just content. And we align those to all of the state standards, and that's how we create our courses. So hence the name Open High School of Utah, because it's all built from the homegrown model that was just referenced. It's open source curriculum. And so we look at the flexibility that that affords to our students and the personal responsibility that they need to have to be able to log in and do their courses in a high-tech environment.
Tell me how this works. So if I sign up my child for an online class, do they have to get a textbook? Is it all online? Do they have to submit papers online, or do they actually have to print something out like in the old days? How does this work in a practical sense?
Okay, that's a great question. So what that looks like is for our full-time students, they receive a laptop computer. We're completely paper-free. We do a lot of collaboration online. For example, we use Google Docs, and the way that works is you can log in and the student writes the paper. There's not even any emailing attachments back and forth. It's completely cloud-based. So the student opens up a Google document, writes their paper, gives their teacher access to that same document real time, and then they can go back and forth and collaborate and make notes and revise and do the things that they need to do. So there are no textbooks, there are no papers, there are no printers required. It's completely online. For our part-time students who are participating in SB 65, they use their home computers. We give them a list of computer requirements that they need to have to be able to do the types of things that we do. And then they are able to use the computers that they have available to them. So they have access anytime, anywhere, any place. They can log in from any computer. They don't have to download things to their personal machine to be able to access Open High School of Utah.
No more excuses of the dog ate my homework, I guess. Kenneth Grover, you mentioned SB 65, Senate Correct. Bill 65. Explain what that does a little more fleshed out.
Great. Yes, Senate Bill 65 was passed in this past legislative session, and it allows students to take online courses from any provider. That's the name or the terminology in the bill. A provider could be anybody outside the school district, or the school district itself could be a provider of that online curriculum. So what it does, it allows parents and students to sit down and consider all the options that are available throughout the state to be able to take a course or courses from anybody that they feel will best meet their needs. And so Senate Bill 65 allows that, and then the funding follows that student. So if a student were to take two courses, say, from a provider, say, from Open High School, then those funds would follow the student and go to that school. And so it's in the best interest of the school districts to start be involved in this process, because if not, potential revenues could leave the school district and go to different providers. And so we want to work hard to give our parents choice within the school system rather than, well, that's all in the school system, but in our local schools rather than perhaps leave.
So the fear that money will go out of our cash-strapped schools is real.
Yeah, it is real. It is real. Now, the money transfers to another school, so it's not necessarily that we're taking it away from. It's just that the money would follow the kid or the student.
Okay. I want to bring another voice into the conversation, Gene V. Glass. He's a research professor in the School of Education and a senior researcher at the National Education Policy Center at the University of Colorado Boulder. He joins us from the studios of KGNU in Boulder. And Professor Glass, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer.
Based on what you've heard in the conversation so far, where does Utah fall in online education? Is it part of a national trend?
Well, it falls right in line with 30 states that have already adopted laws like SB 65. and 20 others that are being vigorously lobbied by a half a dozen large profit-making corporations trying to get the same laws enacted. All this sounds very rosy. I'm afraid the reality of what's happening in online education out there across the country is much messier. Scandalous in some cases.
Tell us more about this. What does all of this mean for quality of learning in your mind?
The quality of the learning is low, non-existent in many cases, because effectively very little is being monitored about the activities of these kids on a laptop in their bedroom, on the kitchen table. In fact, in some cases, Ohio, for example, that has several large online charter schools, the graduation rate for these high school kids was 3%. The dropout rate was enormous. There was no motivation to finish these courses. And in one expose about 3 years ago, it was discovered that half of the kids in large urban online charter didn't even own a computer.
Delana Talks, you started your career in the Ohio online school system. How would you respond to some of these criticisms?
Well, I would say that's a pretty broad brush that is that you're painting online the online picture with. I did teach for 2 years at ECOT, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. I can't speak to their system at this point, but I was part of the evolutionary process where it was a rough beginning. Nobody knew how these systems were supposed to function, and as we've moved along, I would say that now that at the Open High School of Utah, there's actually a better monitoring process than there is in a bricks and mortar classroom, and I'll explain that. The teachers, when I taught school, I taught French and Spanish. I did the same thing 6 times every day in 2 different languages with different groups of students. When I saw those students in the hall, I would say, oh, you're from second period. You're my fifth period class. And I identified the students and defined them by the course that they were taking from me, what period they were in. When you're doing online education, and because our system is so high touch, our teachers know those students, and when they see the student face-to-face, we do a lot of video conferencing, we can say, oh, you're Gary. You're from the Center for Education Reform. You're in Colorado. I know you as an individual, not as a part of a collective. And that gives us the ability to monitor our students much more effectively than trying to look and see what 35 students are doing in a bricks and mortar classroom. You have no idea what the kid in the corner is doing. He may have his textbook out. Is he daydreaming? Our process is completely open and transparent, and it also gives parents and the students the ability to see the curriculum that's being taught 100% open and transparent.
Well, Elena, you're to be commended for what
you've been
doing.
It's actually Delana.
Delane, excuse me.
No problem.
This is not what's going on in the vast majority with the vast majority of the nearly 200,000 kids who are taking full-time education online around this country. In fact, and who are the teachers in these online schools? A huge virtual online school in Arizona with 5,000 students was discovered a year ago outsourcing essay grading to India at $5 an hour. The going rate for these online virtual teachers, most of them uncertified, some with no experience in the classroom, is about $10 an hour. There are 300,000 teachers who have been laid off in the last 2 years in this country. Going down this path of online education is going to do nothing to replacing the teaching core in this country. Obama's jobs bill is looking to put a lot of those teachers who have been laid off back in the classroom. Why aren't school districts going down that avenue instead of sending their money to K-12 Incorporated in Washington, D.C., who's receiving most of this virtual charter school funding? Why aren't they looking forward to rehiring these teachers experienced and certified who have been laid off in this country?
I'll put that question to Kenneth Grover. Why isn't Salt Lake City District using the money to hire teachers instead of looking at online options?
Sure. Well, hey, there's some great points that have been made, and I want to reference back to the bill. Senate Bill 65 is something that happened to school districts where we were not necessarily involved with the dialogue initially. However, when students and parents have the choice to take their courses outside of the school district, we do our very best to offer what otherwise they would take and leave our school districts with. And in the degree that Salt Lake District has been impacted this year by the online, it's been very minimal. We've had around 40 students that have signed up for courses and all of them through our state office education provided electronic high school. However, in the future, we hope that, as both the professor and Ms. Tonks have said, that we can actually provide those teachers jobs because they'll be working in our school system and they'll be teaching in a blended model where students will be taking the coursework online but still interacting with a certified Utah teacher in the classroom here in our Salt Lake District.
Jean Glass, some of your criticisms, I think, may just have to be that it's from a different avenue. Isn't this just an updated version of a correspondence course? I mean, people have been doing mail order classes for years and years. What is the fundamental difference between online learning and something that you get through the mail?
Well, you can't have, well, I took correspondence courses in college, you know, 40 years ago. They weren't very good. They were in no way a substitute for being able to ask a question of a teacher or a professor and getting an answer within a few minutes or having a conversation. You ask one of these online teachers in the vast majority of these schools a question, and you might get an answer 24 or 48 hours later. Hardly a substitute for face-to-face education. The SB 65 and all of its counterparts around the country are written by lobbyists for these huge corporations, the largest of which trades on the New York Stock Exchange. It's a profit-making company founded by Bill Bennett, the author of the Book of Virtues, poor fellow with a gambling addiction, former Secretary of Education, drug czar. This company is making hundreds of millions of dollars funneling courses around the country to kids sitting in their home, getting a stripped-down, inadequate form of education. Where's the PE course? Where's the music course? Where's the chemistry lab? None of it exists in these cases. K-12 Incorporated, through a fundraiser for a guy named Tom Luna in Idaho running for state superintendent of education, raised $50,000 for a state superintendent of education campaign in the state of Idaho. Luna gets a bill through the Idaho legislature that requires 4 online courses of any kid graduating from high school in Idaho. And last spring, his office reprimands a school for having a teacher present in the room when the kids were hooked up to this online course. This is about replacing teachers with laptops. That's the bottom line.
Delana Tonks, your school, the Open High School, has been in business for a couple of years. I imagine that the experience that your students have, you would take an issue with some of the things Professor Glass is mentioning. Maybe talk about the lessons that you've learned in the last couple of years and how you think online education continually is improving and meeting needs.
Absolutely. I think it's difficult to, again, paint online education with such a broad brush and to speak in absolutes. So I have a couple of points I'd like to respond to. The first being our teachers. We do hire full-time teachers, and I know that the 3 online schools that are operating here in the state of Utah do the same thing. They're all full-time teachers dedicated to their specific set of students, just like you have in a face-to-face environment. In fact, at the Open High School of Utah, we have a 100% highly qualified staff. They're all certified teachers. They all spend 4 hours a day in office hours doing nothing but responding to the student. Our response time is so great that students actually start getting twitchy at about the 12-minute mark. If they haven't heard back from the teacher, then I start getting emails and communications that, you know, I send an email to my teacher, I haven't heard back yet. Well, how long has it been? 12 minutes. And so we have a very high response time to meet those students' needs. I want to reframe this conversation and take it out of the context of meeting teachers' needs. I want to put it back on the student because SB 65 and online learning has been a solution in response to what students want and to what parents want. We do offer PE and music online. It just looks a little bit different. It looks like what our Jetsons generation is doing in their spare time. They're on Facebook. They're collaborating on time. On real time on the internet. That's what this generation does. I understand it's difficult for the Flintstones generation to wrap their heads around some of the things that we're able to do using high-tech
high-tech systems and the type of technology that we have to be able to collaborate real-time. So I understand the hesitancy and the resistance to it, but I can assure you that online courses look a lot different from the correspondence courses of 40 years ago. They're much more dynamic and engaging.
Today on the program, how online classes are changing the school experience and learning. We invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. What do you see as the benefits or the downsides of an online education? 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and welcome back to City Views. Today on the program, the virtues and perhaps limitations of an online education. If you've got questions or comments about online classes for your high schooler, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's get our callers on the line. You're on City Views. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. One of the concerns, I worked in a private school for several years, and I won't mention the name, but there were times that parents wanted to get their kids a high school diploma, and they were so desperate for it that sometimes they would want to be overly helpful, as it were. And it occurs to me that one of the problems with online education is how much is allowed or how much could be allowed with parents overly helping their students.
Okay, let's talk about that issue. Thanks very much for the call, Jordan. So I'll put it to you, Kenneth Grover. I guess there is this perception that, boy, we really don't know what students are turning in. Is it their work? Talk about cheating in the online realm.
My experience may not be as in-depth as Ms. Tonks, but you have to remember that online education, the courses and the teachers actually are involved with the students and would know for sure if they've been plagiarizing or other, as well as most courses require, at least in our system, that they're coming to a classroom to take the test and the assessment. So the caller's concerns are valid, and it's something that has to be looked at. However, the checks and balances are readily available. I might add that it's no different than if a parent were helping a student with a paper at home on the computer. We've had similar situations in our school systems now, even without the technology, where it's sometimes hard to know whether a parent's done all the work or not. So I don't know if it's really a large issue, but it's something that we look at and certainly are monitoring.
Gene Glass, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a huge issue. The monitoring of these students' work is much more lax than it is in a face-to-face situation. Here's a instance that was recently discovered in the Denver North High School. They were being fed courses from a company out of Seattle named Apex, which is one of the key players in this whole business. And when it comes to the kid taking the final exam for the math course, these kids all passed around the web address of a website that solves any math problem for you. They all had smartphones. All they did was key in the problem, and then the website solved it for them, and they wrote down the answer on the test. Didn't learn anything except what they already knew, which was really smart, how to run a smartphone, how to get to a website.
Delana, I'd like to hear your thoughts on cheating and how you can prevent it. What are the safeguards in place for that?
Sure thing. Jordan, you make a very, very good point, and that's something that we share your concerns with. We want to make sure that our students are the ones who are actually doing the work. Three things. The first one is parent training. We provide an orientation and set the parameters and the boundaries for what is and is not acceptable parental intervention with their students. The second thing is knowing the students, and we do a lot of video conferencing. We work face-to-face with our students, and as a teacher, as a former teacher, I have 14 years of teaching experience. You get to know those students. You know what their work looks like. If they turn something in that has zero grammatical errors and it's 100% correct when they've got a C average going on in your class, big warning lights go off. So we're able to use the data to make sure that the students are the ones that are doing the work. And the technology, we have timed tests. We can lock them out of other browsers as they're working. They don't have enough time to look up answers on their smartphones because they have 40 minutes to complete, you know, a 40-question test or whatever the case may be.
So in your case, Delana, you actually do not have a physical setting for a test. You don't require kids to come in and be monitored by a proctor.
No, we let the technology do that for us, and it's actually worked out quite well. Out of the 111 schools that the data that just came out for our state-mandated tests, we rank number 18 for our test scores. So I would say that our educational methods and efforts are absolutely paying off, and when you compare the data from our pass rate for our students, it's right in line with the state-mandated tests that are proctored and are third-party.
Hmm.
Delana, if I could ask, how many students are enrolled in the Open High School of Utah?
That's a great question. We have 9th through 12th grades this year. It's our third year of operation. We have about 350 full-time students and about 60 who are participating through SB 65.
Mm-hmm. I want to get
there. There are 200,000 students doing their entire high school experience is online in this country right now. It's nothing like
great. What's
going on. Everything might be hunky-dory in Utah. That's not what's going on nationwide.
All right. Jordan, thanks so much for the call. I want to get to this email from Connor. He writes, I taught for 4 years at a laptop high school and saw both the advantages and disadvantages of online and computer-based curriculum. It occurs to me that high school is a bit too early to go to a completely online curriculum because of the onus that puts on students who might not be mature enough to monitor themselves or their work. Jean Glass, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, and then we'll go to our other guests.
Well, definitely. So I have taught. I may be in the Flintstone generation. I'm probably in some generation far before that even. I've taught online courses at the graduate level in statistics, and I'm not even satisfied with how it substitutes for face-to-face instruction. So if graduate students aren't mature enough in some ways to profit fully from this experience, how is a 14, 15, 16-year-old going to do it? I don't think they do pull it off very well.
Kenneth Grover, Salt Lake City Schools.
You know, I agree. That is why with this bill, Senate Bill 65, it is not a bill that allows students to be completely high school immersed in an online. It would allow them to take an online course or two currently in our system. I'm of the opinion that a blended model where they're in the classroom with the teacher at some point once, twice, three times a week, as well as then doing their coursework online, seems to be the best model, and that seems to be where a large majority of the country is moving, at least in the schools that I have visited across the country.
All right. We're speaking with Kenneth Grover, Director of Career and Technical Education and Secondary Schools at the Salt Lake City School District. Also with us, Delana Tonks, Director of the Open High School of Utah and All Online at Charter School. And Jean Glass, a research professor in the School of Education at the University of Colorado Boulder. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about online education. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send us an email, cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Candace in Salt Lake City. Candace, welcome. Candace, hi. Problems with the phones. 801-355-TALK. Let's go to Chris in Salt Lake City. Chris, hi. Apparently, we're having phone issues. We will get back to you on that. I want to go to Delana Tonks again and talk about the maturity level. Is there a screening process, some way to say, you, applicant, you are mature enough to handle the pressures of working on your own, being independent and self-directed? Or does the Open High School of Utah just say, okay, whoever wants to try this, take a stab at it and we'll see how it goes?
That is an excellent question, and I don't disagree that this is not the right fit for every student. And I'm going to bring the conversation back to being about the student. This is a choice, and some students function very well in this setting, and some don't. Some graduate students don't function well in this setting. Some 14-year-olds handle it absolutely well. So I think we have to step away from the one-size-fits-all online looks like this, because there are all sorts of different options out there. So what we do is we provide training to our students. We give them an overview and manage their expectations. This is what school is going to look like if you choose to sign up with the Open High School of Utah. And I want to point out that we are a public charter school and that we do accept all students. We don't have a process by which we can determine you get to come and you don't. We take everybody just like your neighborhood or your district school. But we do manage their expectations. Hmm. And when they come in, they know exactly what they're getting into. But it's not like they're left on their own with a laptop and sink or swim, let's see how well you can do this. They have life preservers. They have their teachers that they can contact. They have the administration. They have their counselors. And if they have any questions, they can get that instantaneous response time, what they need, when they need it, so that they can move on.
Kenneth Grover, how about Salt Lake City School District? How are you envisioning making sure that this is a good fit for the student who's applying for an online class?
Great. Yes, all right. Our goal is that within the year, we'd like to be able to create a blended learning model in our school district where, as Delaine had alluded to, where students who express interest or parents who expressed interest in an online course are able to sign up along with the teacher in the classroom and take the course. So the course is both online and with the teacher. I might add also that this is a choice option. If the student is not being successful and we're monitoring it, we can put them back into a classroom that's face-to-face. But mm-hmm. we do believe the online technology and those the ability that it offers students is really where it needs to be. There are a number of students who, for which normal high school does not work, or for which a couple of classes they might choose to take online because of perhaps they're trying to graduate early, or perhaps they have some other kind of academic goals.
Okay. I want to get our callers involved again. We'll see if the phones are working now. 801-355-TALK. And hi, you're on City Views.
You're letting me call in.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Well, I've been listening, obviously, to this discussion, and it was interesting. Mr. Glass obviously has an idea about how Senate Bill 65 initiated, or who was involved, or who were the players behind it. It seems a little bit like he has some conspiracy theories, but I guess I just wanted to share a little bit of my experience. I'm calling from the organization that initiated and partnered with Senator Stevenson. I can tell you this wasn't about a single provider. Obviously, we can't expect an expert from out of state to understand the nuances of the political process within our own. And I wouldn't want that kind of discussion to put a certain light on the discussion today.
Judy, thanks very much for the call. Gene Glass, I don't know how to say it. Maybe, you know, we know best in Utah how to handle our students. How would you respond to that?
Good luck. well, good luck. There's a lot of PR going on all over the country, pushed by these corporations, by a few individuals, about what a wonderful option this is to real education. And it's a shame. Look what's going on in Florida. Under Jeb Bush as governor, Florida developed an online virtual school that rose to an attendance of 50,000 students. Right now, Bush is preparing to take that school private under his ownership, profit-making, using all the development monies that were public, and turn it into online virtual charters. His family will pocket millions and millions of dollars out of this venture. The same family that brought you the Iraq War couldn't tell the difference between an empty aluminum pipe and a WMD. Now they want to educate your kids. Lots of luck.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's hear from Chris in Salt Lake City. Chris, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm an academic technologist. I work at Westminster College with their Division of New Learning, where we provide a low residency business degree for graduates and undergraduates. And ours is a hybrid course where it's a low residency, so students come in once every 4 months, and then they come in and they do projects, and then they get help from their professors as coaches. So it works with the Clayton Christensen Innovative University idea of moving professors from being the sage on the stage to being the guide on the side, so people who help students with their learning. And I think this would work really well in a K-12 setting, because cognitive science shows us that students will learn better if what they're trying to learn is based on something that they're trying to figure out, if it's something they're trying to base a something in their passion. So the idea that, like, online is bad and classroom is good or vice versa seems to be kind of the wrong argument. It seems to be, is it engaging and is the education coming across to students in a way that cognitive science shows us the students learn?
So the hybrid situation is working well in your experience.
Yes, it is. We find that our students are a lot more engaged because basically instead of reading a book and then regurgitating the information back on a test, our students are given a problem or an issue saying find out how to market this new product and bring it into a new market. And then they go out and find the information with the help from a specialized coach and then finding out information from other specialists, whether it's online or from their these are working adults, so they can go to their boss and they can go to those sorts of things. But those sorts of models could still work in a K-12 setting.
Chris, thanks for the call. Kenneth Grover, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I just want to jump in on that. Clayton Christensen also wrote a book called Disrupting Class in 2008. And if you want to get a better feel for where we believe it's going, at least within our district and within the state, you just need to peruse that book to see that we're not saying that it's going to replace education, but online education probably will be the innovative disruptor for the next 6 years here in education. And it behooves us to look and see how students are learning, how students are accessing technology along with their parents and providing the best type of environment for students to learn. Now, granted, maybe some of the online companies that have been referred to, some of their courses aren't all that great, but we can make great courses. I think perhaps the online school here in Utah that Ms. Tonks is in charge of certainly offers great courses, and I'm sure that if there are courses that aren't meeting the needs of the students, they have alter and adjust and rewrite that curriculum accordingly. But I think it would be foolish, and I'm trying just to be kind here, but it's foolish to think that if we're going to move forward over the next 5 years, that if we're not talking about online education in the public education setting, I think we have our blinders on. It's something that parents are looking for. It's something that students want. We need to make it better. We need to deliver it better, and we need to provide it for them in a format that allows for all the things to occur.
A follow-up question from Joshua, who's calling from Salt Lake City. Josh, hi, you're on the line.
Yes, I have two questions. One, if this is such a good idea, why is it that it has to be done by private corporations versus the public school district? Because quite honestly, I don't trust private corporations to educate children equitably. And then also, I was curious if anyone has thought about, I'm currently enrolled at the University of Utah, and in my quantum mechanics class, it's kind of a hybrid of half online, half in class, where we watch a video lecture that the professor has put up online, and then we go to class and we do group work where the professor walks around, and this is a really good setting because then the professor knows where the class is at. It's a lot more interactive and a lot funner for the students, and it also lets the professor kind of gauge where the class is and find out where he needs to talk about and where we're doing all right.
All right, Joshua, thanks so much for the call. Gene Glass, that kind of his first statement echoes a sentiment that you shared with us earlier about this fear of outsourcing our education.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the educator is going to be responsible to their shareholders, not to the students, not to the parents. This is not a good situation. There's been talk about the hybrid model, which is the same face-to-face time that has existed traditionally in education, but with a technology support out of class for submission of papers, communicating in different ways. Virtually every course in higher education these days runs on a hybrid model like that. And nobody that I think has a responsible opinion in this area doubts that that addition of technology to traditional forms of higher education has been a benefit. But a form of education in which a so-called teacher wouldn't recognize a so-called student if they met them on the street, That's not an education in my book.
Mm. Delana Talks, tell us about the qualifications of the teachers who teach at the Open High School. Are they required to have the certifications that a classroom teacher has, or is it somewhat different?
That's a great question. We are 100% highly qualified. They're all certified teachers. And in fact, what we can do at the Open High School of Utah that's difficult to do in a bricks and mortar setting is that I have access to pull the very best teachers from across the state of Utah. I'm not relegated to a geographic area for teachers to drive into a bricks and mortar building within a 50-mile radius. And so the process that we go through to determine who we are hiring is very rigorous. I get 150 applications, all certified teachers, and they come across my desk. I don't have time to look through those all. So we give them a congratulatory email and say, you are moving on to the next level of our interview process, which is to build some curriculum for us. We want to see what you can do. You need to include a screencast so we can see what your screen presence looks like, because that's how you're going to be communicating with your students. And about 15 of the candidates actually do that. So right there, 135 of them self-deselect. We take those top 15, look through them, make sure that they've included the elements that we believe are important to an online learning experience, which is that the curriculum that they put together is dynamic, engaging, they understand what interests the teenage students, and then we interview the top three. And what we've come up with is a world-class faculty. One of them is the STEM winner, the Presidential STEM Award winner. They select two from every state. We have one of the top five online educators in the nation at our school, and we also have the Charter Educator of the Year from 2010. So we do have a world-class faculty, and they're all 100% highly qualified.
Only got a couple of minutes left. I'd like to get final thoughts from our guests. Jean Glass, let's start with you. Where are we headed? Do you see a day when we completely abandon the schoolhouse and just gather for social events and other enrichment activities, but classes all online?
We may be headed in that direction. I worry that we're headed too much in that direction. If that day ever comes, we will have lost so much of what's valuable in public education in this country.
Final thoughts, Kenneth Grover.
Yeah, I agree. We're moving towards a blended model. We believe the ability for students to interact both in the classroom and online needs to be addressed and be met. But I'm in the agreement that we need to walk very wisely into this new frontier, and that we develop courses and an experience for students that involves both the technology and meeting their needs.
And Delana Tonks, your final thoughts.
Yeah, I agree. This isn't a one-size-fits-all exercise. This is about providing options for students that meet their individual needs. Similar to, you can have 27 different burger joints. It's the same piece of meat, cheese, lettuce, and a bun, but people put it together differently to meet the needs of their consumers.
Delana Tonks, she is the director of the Open High School of Utah. Also with us, Kenneth Grover from Salt Lake City School District, and Jean Glass with the National Education Policy Center at the University of Colorado Boulder. Thanks to all of you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And you can continue the discussion online, kcpw.org. Up next, a primer on a new survey targeting what caregivers need. But first, we need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back to City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Taking care of a loved one is often a full-time job, and Salt Lake County wants to know how it can help. The county is in full swing with an online survey on caregiver needs. And joining me now to talk about the effort is Kathy Nelson. She is a caregiver trainer with Salt Lake County Aging Services. Kathy, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thanks, Jennifer, for having me on your inaugural show. This is great.
Well, so tell me about the survey. How did this effort get underway, and why?
Well, as we have an aging population coming up over the next 20 years specifically, we have a minimum of about 200,000 caregivers in Salt Lake County at any given time. And that's a really conservative number based on one caregiver for one aging senior. And so we want to make sure that the programs we offer, the training we offer, the websites we build for you over the next, 5 to 10 years are going to really handle us through this aging situation.
200,000 folks in the county. That's a large chunk of the population.
It is.
Tell us about these people. Give us an example of who is a caregiver in the county.
When we talk about caregivers from Salt Lake County Aging Services, we're talking about family members that are actually caring for either an aging parent that's 60 or older that needs a little bit of help with, let's say, walking or making meals or cleaning their home, the small things that allow them to stay in the home and be independent longer. We want to answer that senior need saying, I want to stay in my home as long as possible. So we're working toward those things. That's the type of caregiver we work with. We also work with aging caregivers that are individuals 60 and older that may be caring for an aging spouse or that might be raising their grandchildren because their children are not able to for any given reason. And so we have this new population of grand families developing as well. Mm-hmm. So it can be any family caregiver. It's just a really big, broad group of individuals.
So it must be difficult to get a handle on exactly what they need, this diverse group of people. And I guess why is the county concerned about this? Why invest time and money in helping caregivers do that full-time job?
Well, there's a couple really important reasons, and one of them's funding. Can you imagine what would happen if everyone had to place their senior in a nursing facility over the next 20 years with the baby boomer population? There is just not going to be enough beds available. So, and we know that that's not what seniors want. And if we're going to get involved and help people stay independent longer, we have to start doing that now so that we have the right things in place, information. Even if they're private paying for certain services, we need to know where they're at, who has them, approximately how much they cost, so that we can help caregivers set up family plans that allow this to take place.
So that's the real incentive. I mean, there is
a money
component to it.
There's a huge money component.
Keeping people out of a nursing home situation, allowing them to be as independent as possible for as long as possible.
As long as possible, exactly.
Okay. This is the first caregiver survey the county has conducted, I understand.
It is. We've only been a program in the U.S. government system for about 10 years. We've been part of Aging Services the whole time. Caregiver support in Utah really is a front runner for some of the things that are happening across the nation. We get a lot of calls from long-distance caregivers, call in from Washington or India or Mexico or wherever they're calling from, and they're saying, my parents live with my sibling in Salt Lake County. So it's really quite a diverse population.
So give us a sense of the kind of questions that you're asking in the survey. What are you hoping to discover through this interview process?
One, like every survey, there's going to be some demographics. And people have asked me, why do you have these demographics in here? Well, money's attached to demographics. Various groups and charities, et cetera, provide money to specific demographics that they focus on. So one, you're going to have some demographics questions, and they're all important. Other questions are going to be things like, what do you really need in your home? Is it housekeeping? Is it how to change a catheter? Is it how to lift someone properly from the chair back into their wheelchair? Where do I, you know, what kind of classes would you want to come to? What do you want to learn about as a caregiver? Do you even know how to be a safe caregiver? Do you know what the laws are in Utah? Do you know about adult protective services? All those kinds of things. And if we don't know what you know versus what we need you to know plus what you need from us, it's going to get really complicated.
Sure.
There's going to be a lot of holes.
Yeah. So what kinds of services specifically can the county help with?
Well, we have contracted services that we provide for caregivers. We do have an intake process, and there are some eligibility stats that you would ask about as you call. But we can provide things like daycare systems, in-home cleaning, transportation, senior companions. Aging Services also obviously has its Meals on Wheels programs, its senior centers, free training, free classes on how to be a caregiver, as well as just every aspect of caregiving. My head is so full of anything that we could offer you. I'm not really sure what to say today because there's just everything out there from understanding the diseases you're going through to how to deal with specific behaviors and how to deal with hallucinations or anything like that that come up every day in your home and you're really not sure what to do about it. Mm. Or how do you set up a family planning calendar and get the whole family involved? How do you set up those things so that you're not wanting to wipe each other out along the way?
Sure.
You know?
I understand Salt Lake County is under a fair bit of financial pressure right now. You're looking to fill a $17 million shortfall. I guess my question for you is, why are you asking these questions now when money's tight? I mean, it's not like you can expand the services for this caregiving population.
The staff at Salt Lake County Aging Services is very aware that we are going into one of our largest populations with our shortest amount of funds. So we're asking these questions to make sure that we are using your money wisely. We have 65 different funding sources that we use, from federal to state to county to city to donations to private to public. All these things are coming together, and all of them have laws about the way we can use them. And we want to make sure that we are maximizing every penny we have in a way that makes sense to Utah's caregivers and are used according to the way you need it, so that we're not wasting one dime that comes through our door. And that's difficult if we don't know exactly what you need from us. So we're asking it now because we know there may be less paid services we can offer you, but that doesn't mean our websites and our information and our links shouldn't be, you know, really well designed.
So if money were no obstacle, what would the county like to be able to provide in terms of support to caregivers? I mean, if you had your wish list, what would it look like?
Well, I mean, for me personally, because I work in the caregiver support program, I'd like to see more respite available to our county caregivers. Stress management is one of the number one things that they really have to deal with all the time. And if I could just give them a few hours to themselves to take a nap, to read their mail, to do anything that really is part of just managing a good, healthy, balanced life. We have so many caregivers that work. You know, if I could pay for daycare more or things like that, that's what I would love to be able to do, to offer that respite, that relaxation, so that they can continue to be healthy, productive caregivers in the midst of this aging process.
Kathy Nelson, she's a caregiver trainer with Salt Lake County Aging Services. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jennifer.
And there's a link to the caregiver survey on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News with help from Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org or check us out on Facebook or Twitter. Next time, a conversation about the recent attacks on three gay men in Utah and where we as a community are going. That's coming up tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.